The 19th chapter of the book of Genesis is one of those difficult passages in the scripture to address in a congregation like ours this evening, where we have a diverse age range, and to deal with the issues that are contained here. Well, yes, it's difficult, but at the same time, there are principles that are so obviously, glaringly evident that it doesn't take a great deal of digging to draw out from this some pertinent application for us today. I don't really want to go into the story much more than I already have by reading the chapter to you. There's certainly no need for me to explain very much of it. It's self-evident, the degree of wickedness of the city of Sodom that has become a byword for sexual perversion. Now, as we think about this chapter this evening, we really need to consider this episode in the light of a New Testament passage. It's found in 2 Peter and the second chapter, where in verses 4 and following we read these words. If God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, if, by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment, and especially those who indulge in the lust of defiling passion and despise authority. Now, why do I say that we need to keep this passage in mind as we consider the 19th chapter of Genesis? Well, the reason is because if it were not for this passage, we would have a very wrong view of Lot, I fear. He was a despicable man. Well, that's what one commentator says of him. A disgusting man. When you think about what he suggested to the men of Sodom concerning his daughters, what kind of man would do that? Even to protect some strangers that had come to his home for lodging. No, when we read Genesis chapter 19, the word righteousness doesn't come into our minds at all, but rather the exact opposite, and not only applied to the citizens of Sodom, but also that man who chose to sojourn there. Now, we must then keep 2 Peter 2, verses 6 to 9, in mind. A categorical statement emphasized by the repetition of the word righteousness in describing Lot. That righteous, three times righteous man. Not the word we would use to describe him, but it is the word that Peter uses to describe him. So, thinking about that, and we'll come back to Peter a little later on, let's look at chapter 19 of Genesis under three headings. Firstly, to consider the culture. The culture of Sodom was one of overt, blatant wickedness. There's absolutely no way that we can try to diminish the seriousness of the sin in Sodom. It reminds us, doesn't it, of Paul's words, his opening chapter to the church in Rome. In Romans chapter 1 and verse 18, Paul writes that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. He goes on to tell us that what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power, divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonourable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. This is a description of Sodom. More than 2,000 years before Paul wrote these words. It fits. Here were men and women who had exchanged natural functions of the body for that which is unnatural and perverted. And God has seen. The cry has gone out from the region. No doubt other visitors to these cities have been less well preserved and protected than these visitors to Lot. And the cry of them has gone out. And the Lord has said, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave. And so these angels come to bring judgment upon a city in which there are not even 10. Righteous people. Indeed, so perverted are they that the words of the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 4 apply in this situation. With respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you. This was normal. I mean, you look at the story and the description that we have is that the men came to Lot's house from every corner of the city, both small and great. It didn't matter what background they were from. The unemployed, the working class, the rich, the wealthy, they all mingled together at the door of Lot's house. All were equally corrupt. It was a thorough plague that infected the minds and hearts and beings of these people. This was the culture of the city in which Lot lived. Perhaps our culture has not slipped quite so far as this. But it's close to it. And how does Lot react? Well, we already know that Sodom had a reputation for wickedness before Lot even moved there. Indeed, when the disagreement arose between Lot's servants and Abram's servants, and they decided to part, to separate peacefully, we're told that Lot chose for himself the Jordan Valley in which these cities were located. We're told that Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. And then Moses records the comment, "Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. And yet Lot has moved his tent as far as Sodom." But that isn't the end of his progress, or perhaps a better word for it would be downgrade. For indeed, Sodom becomes not only a place of sojourning, but a place of dwelling for Lot. You see, when Abram was called because the kings of a region further away had conquered the kings of Sodom and the surrounding area, we're told that they also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom. And they took his possessions and went their way. So he has moved his tent as far as Sodom, but then he's living in Sodom. But it doesn't end there. As this story begins in verse 1 of chapter 19, and these angels come to Sodom in the evening, we're told that Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. He's sitting there now among the leaders of the city. He's sitting alongside, shoulder to shoulder, with these evil men who have a reputation for their wickedness that is worldwide in its extent, even at this time. They're known for it, and there he is. He is so settled in Sodom that he is accepted as one of them. Now let's not forget what Peter says. In 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 8, this righteous man is tormenting himself. That's what Peter says. That righteous man lived among them day after day. He was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. Every day he was confronted with the wickedness of Sodom. Every day he was tormented by the things that he saw and heard, and every day he chose to stay there. He sojourned, he dwelt, he sat among them by his own choice. This righteous man was tormenting himself by his choice. He was a righteous man. We'll come back to that in a moment. But he lived among such wickedness, and he lived there by his own choice. And there's only one word that we can use to describe this. It's compromise. It's compromising with the culture of his day. He's compromising with the wickedness that surrounds him. He may not be openly involved in the wicked actions, but he sits alongside those who are. He calls them brothers. In fact, so settled is he in this city that his two daughters are engaged, betrothed to the men of Sodom. This city was his daughter's nursery. This city where he sits in the gate with the leading men has nurtured and raised his daughters because he chose to settle there. Tormented himself in his soul, conscious of the wickedness around him, battling perhaps to keep his own heart and life uninfected. But all the time, his daughters are moving among these people, are being taught by these people, molded by these people, because Lot is happy to live among this people, to settle among this people. He feels it. It's not that he is completely indifferent to what is going on around him, but he loves it too much. There's aspects of this life, the comforts that Sodom affords him, the status perhaps that it has given him, a sense of security even, though certainly from the earlier story, one wonders about the degree of security that they had. And yet, this is the place that Lot has chosen to raise his daughters. This is the place he has chosen to settle his family. This is the place that he daily chooses not to move away from. And you see, we know that it isn't simply a matter of opportunity. He's got too many business ties there. It would be difficult for him to uproot and move away. No, we're told that in the imminent destruction that is about to fall upon this city, when the angels tell him to get up, to take his wife, to get out of the city with his daughters, he lingered. There's an urgency there to escape from the destruction such that these men seize him. And his wife and his daughters, they physically drag him out of the city. So reluctant is he to relieve this den of iniquity. It's interesting. The words that are used here are exactly the same as the words that describe Lot's use or Lot's approach to the men when they first arrive. When these angels first arrive in the city, he says, "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way." He's inviting them home, and he's going to push them out of the door as soon as it's light, that they can get out of the city as quickly as possible. When they turn around and say to him, "No, we'll spend the night in the square. We'll be perfectly comfortable there. Thank you very much." He pressed them strongly. One commentator translates it, he manhandled them. It may have literally involved physically taking hold of their arms and pulling them towards his house. You see, he knows what will happen if they stay in the square of the city. He knows what kind of people he lives among. And he sees these people, these men come in. He obviously recognized in them something that Abraham had recognized. These were not ordinary travelers. My Lord, please turn aside to your servant's house, spend the night, wash your feet. And he provides them with a feast, it's described. He knows that these men are not fit for this place. He knows that they will become the targets of the wickedness of the men of this city. And he draws them in. You see, he has this fear of the wickedness of the city, and yet he has this love for the city such that he himself has to be dragged away from it. It was a culture of wickedness with which Lot was willing to compromise. Not entirely happy and comfortable in it, but certainly unwilling to let go of it. Is that how we view our culture, our world? You young Christians here this evening, you see the lives of your friends at school. You see the things that make them tick, the kind of pleasures that they enjoy, and you recognize in it that there's aspects of behavior that is not right for a Christian, and yet there is so much that you like, that you love, that you want. And there's this tension perhaps in your own mind, in your own thinking, that somewhat resembles Lot's. You torment yourself to some degree, but you don't want to let it go. You want to keep those friends. You want to keep those relationships. You want to keep those pleasures. You want to fit in. You want to sit among them. You don't want to stand out. You don't want to be different. You don't want to be thought weird. And in doing so, you compromise with a culture of wickedness that God hates. Now, there's a third thing that we have to see in this passage. That out of this compromise with this culture, there are obvious consequences. There are consequences. Lot's unwillingness to leave this city has not left him untouched by its influence. We see that in the episode there of him offering his daughters to this rabble of men at his door. No, I think Lot must have been an incredibly brave man. He is a mob who are their saliva is running from their mouths like a dog about to pounce upon its prey. And he goes out of his house and confronts them. He must have been incredibly brave to have done such a thing. But brave as he might have been, he was also a very foolish man. When he went out to the men and he pleads with them not to act so wickedly, he offers his own daughters to them as playthings. Now, one commentator suggests that in Lot's mind was the fact that his daughters are betrothed to men of the city. They have a legally binding understanding with men in the city, and such was the custom and law of the nations at that time in this region, that for a man to have taken one of these girls and to lain with her would have meant the death sentence. So the commentator suggests that in Lot's mind, is he's sort of playing with these men. He's trying to get them into a situation where they begin fighting themselves. And they bring themselves under the condemnation of their own law. Well, I don't know really how far that may be true. He's obviously a desperate man. He's seen something in these visitors that causes him to want to protect them at such an incredible risk and cost. There's a parallel story in Judges chapter 19, the outcome of which is far from pleasant. And it could have been the same outcome here, but for the grace of God. But my point is this, that the kind of thinking of the Sodomites has infiltrated Lot's mind. He's been tormented. He knows their wickedness. He's tried to keep that way of thinking out of his mind. But when he's pushed to a point, you see it flowing out. His heart has been polluted by the wickedness of this city. And his choices are the choices of the city. They fit, you see, with this culture in which he has lived now for years. We see another consequence in his wife, that they are dragged out of the city by the angels and told to flee, to run, to not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. We read of Lot's wife stopping and looking behind her, and she becomes a pillar of salt. Of course, there's also a Lot's unwillingness to even flee as far as the hills. He wants still to live in the city, in the valley. He pleads for one of the cities. It's only a small city. It's only a little. Isn't it little? Isn't it insignificant, he says. Oh, isn't that the way we think sometimes about our compromise with this culture that we live in? Oh, it's such a small thing. It's only a little thing. It's not a troubling thing. But after the destruction comes upon Sodom and Gomorrah, we find that Lot is quick to move from the city that he had chosen and does decide to live in the hills. Perhaps it was the threat of retaliation from the inhabitants of that one city. We don't know for sure why it was that he feared for his life in Zoar. The Lot's wife, you see, her love for Sodom was such that she could not turn away from it. Dragged out by the hand, but her heart was still there. And she dies. And then we have that final chapter in the story of Lot's life. We never hear about him again after this. You know, Lot's daughters have been thoroughly infected with the thinking of the city of Sodom. They're fearful for the future. Who will look after them? Who will care for them? They need an offspring preserved. This is not a concern for the future of mankind, as one commentator put it. They think that they're the only ones alive. How could they think that they're the only ones alive? They've lived in Zoar after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It isn't that the extremity of the valley was completely destroyed, such that these two girls think that they and their father are the only living souls upon planet Earth. No, they've lived in Zoar. This isn't a noble desire to keep the earth populated with humanity, and a desperate bid to do so. This is much more to do with their own desire for security and safety, to raise up an offspring who will care for them, who will protect them as they grow older. And their whole way of going about this is wrong. And we shouldn't be surprised that it's wrong, because they have been nurtured and nursed in the arms of Sodom, you see. They are children of Sodom as much as they're children of Lot. And Lot's daughter's response then: he has no real part in it. The scriptures are emphatic. He did not know when she came in, when she went out. He did not know. This was their doing, orchestrated by them. The consequence, you see, of compromise with culture runs deep. Now, after all of that story, how can we say, how can Peter say, that Lot was a righteous man? This compromiser, who loved Sodom more than life, wicked, corrupt, vile Sodom, more than obedience to God, how can we call him a righteous man? Well, on what basis do we call Noah a righteous man? Blameless in his generation is the way that he's described in the book of Genesis. Well, consider that passage in 2 Peter. The passage that declares that Lot is righteous also speaks of Noah as being a preacher of righteousness. If God did not spare the ancient world but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, he was a preacher of righteousness. But the writer of Hebrews tells us still more. In that chapter of men and women of faith, Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 7, we read, "By faith Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of righteousness that comes by obedience to God." No, an heir of righteousness that comes by obeying the law. No. An heir of righteousness that comes by avoiding strong drink. No, Noah became a drunkard. An heir of righteousness that comes by faith. On what basis is Abraham, Lot's uncle, declared to be righteous? Well, there we have it. We've studied it before. Chapter 15 of Genesis and verse 6. He believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. It is the righteousness that comes by faith. How is it that the Apostle Peter can emphatically declare that Lot is a righteous man? Because Lot had faith in God. It may have been minimal faith. It may have been a halting faith. It may have been a stumbling, weak faith. But it was nevertheless a faith in God. He had accompanied Abram out of Ur of the Chaldees. He had journeyed with Abram for many years before their prosperity had forced them to separate. And certainly while he was not a man of the stature of Abraham, Abraham presented to us as this great example of faith in God. Nevertheless, Lot's righteousness can and is only attributed to him on the basis of faith, just as anyone's righteousness in the scriptures is based on faith in God. We are not saved by blameless living. For none of us are blameless. Noah wasn't blameless. Abraham wasn't blameless. We've seen episodes of faithlessness in Abraham's life, and we will see more. Indeed, in the very next passage, we will see Abram's fall again. No, these men are not blameless. They're not perfect. They're not righteous as Jesus Christ is righteous. They are righteous because Jesus Christ is righteous, and the righteousness of the one in whom they hope and trust and believe is imputed to them. It becomes theirs because they believe, because they have faith. And what lesson then must we take out of this sad, sad story of Lot and his demise? Well, it's this, that Lot was a righteous man because of his faith, but he was also a compromised believer. And we shouldn't take comfort in the midst of our sins that we have Lot as our hero. His life was a mess. He ends up living in a cave in the hills. His prosperity all lost because of foolish, sinful choices that he made. Peter declares that the righteous are scarcely saved. And therefore, he urges in his first letter that we ought to make our calling and election sure. We need to strive, work at our salvation. Not in the sense of earning our salvation, but in the sense of not jeopardizing our salvation. That's the repeated warning of the book of Hebrews over and over and over again. Is the warning that we can be so close to being saved, but not be. And Lot was just on the other side of that. He was just saved. He could have been almost lost. The point is this, that we cannot risk compromise on the basis of God's grace and mercy. Lot found favour in the eyes of God, and God saved him. He plucked this one righteous man out of that city of Sodom that was destined for destruction. God was merciful to Lot despite all his failings and sins. That is the mercy of God. But if you live your life compromising with the world on the basis that God will do for you what he did for Lot, you risk an eternity in hell. It is simply not worth it in this life or the next.